A big shout out goes to Maxxis Tires, Jensen USA, and Fox Shocks for supporting the Inside Line.
I get relatives from Amanda's side that send me videos like, hey, did you see this?
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, I did 8 months ago. But it reaches people. And I guess that goes into our topic we're saying before of how accessible is the sport now. And I think it's amazing. It's cool to see inspirational things where I don't think I'm going to rampage and riding any of this, but people get stoked on bikes. And I think that's cool. And it's part of the coverage with World Cup, with Rampage, with all this stuff. And I think that coverage and, you know, cycling being more normal in all its forms is really cool.
I think that's a good segue to tell everyone why we're here. Again, for the third time, fourth time. It's still recording. We're 10 minutes in, so that's a bonus. It's a success, a victory. Welcome, mountain bikers. This is the Inside Line. We're doing ride-along version with every single vital editorial staffer and some contributors. We have Johan Hjord here. We have Nils Hjord here. We have Rick Reed, Johnny, Jason, Steve Wentz, Amanda Wentz. We're all in Reno celebrating Cam Zink's Rampage win.
Go Cam!
No, that's not why we're here, but it's pretty sick. Feel the energy, right? We're doing what we call internally our cheap bike mountain bike test. And that means the bikes are $3,000 or less. I think the most expensive is $2,800. Some are down to $2,000. And yeah, just worked out. Johan happened to be here on a planned vacation. We got everyone hanging out. It's been a fun day. Steve, you had some stuff you wanted to talk about. And it kind of was on that topic of the accessibility of bikes.
Yeah, I think I have somewhat of the hot take of the sport is that it's more affordable and more accessible than ever. I mean, I know my bikes are amazing. They're fun. Everyone in this room has really high-end expensive bikes, but you don't have to have that whole getup, that whole, you know, $10,000 ensemble to have a really good time. And I think my perspective comes from, you know, I started out when I guess the most expensive bike was $5,000-$6,000, and that's in the late 90s. And now every cheap bike is a half or a third the price, and it works way better. And it's even cheaper based on inflation, you know? So I think it is more accessible than ever, even though a lot of the flash and a lot of the views and stuff is on a new high-end expensive thing. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, it was. You've been involved in all three of these that we've done. Jason, Johnny, Johan, you'd never hopped aboard bikes this inexpensive for the sake of testing, at least. And it was pretty fun this morning. Everyone saw the bikes for the first time and were discussing which brakes might not stop them, which wheels might explode, which suspension's going to bottom out. But Johan, let's get your take on what you felt the day was like. It seemed like towards the end of the day, everyone was pretty psyched on what the bikes could actually do.
Yeah, absolutely. And just taking it back one step to Steve's point there, in terms of where mountain biking was and where we are today, if you look back, 15, 20 years when I got into the sport, riding a mountain bike trail was by definition very gnarly because those trails weren't purpose-built really. They just happened to be there, or somebody, you know, vaguely would rake in a line and then try and ride it on a bike that was more or less fit for purpose. And we used to wear a lot of body armor because bikes would break and we would crash a lot. And that was just how you got into the sport. You know, you needed to break something yourself or the equipment. And we spent a lot of time just fixing stuff. Like, it was just par for the course. You know, oh, my wheel broke. Yeah, of course it did again. You know, I just hit that rock a bit too hard and the thing just tacoed. That just happened. You know, that was mountain biking. So today, to the point, you can have a totally different experience for way less money. The bikes we've been riding here today, you can pretty much all of them ride out of the box. You can get down some pretty gnarly terrain. It's super hard. For the last 5 years, if you tried to pick a bike that's been a real bad bike in terms of geometry, that almost doesn't happen anymore. Like, we know, the industry knows where the numbers should be, and so irrespective of budget, how much you throw at the part spec or frame material choice, you can make a good bike that rides properly, because we all trialed and errored the mistakes going back 15 years ago. There was geometry that was literally unrideable, and we still rode it because that's what we had. So this experience here has been quite an eye opener Because even in the last few years, I think these supposedly, you know, so-called cheap mics, it's still a fair amount of money if you're coming off a Walmart build, but relatively speaking, they're affordable for a high-end piece of sports equipment. They have come a long way, and you know, we all had a blast. We rode a few different bikes. I don't think I rode the worst one, because I've been around long enough to know to pick the good ones. So I rode the best ones in this test. But yeah, I had a blast. Like I didn't have to stop twice and think, hey, is my bike going to do this or whatever? My limitation was, as always, me. And that's a good place to be, where you can trust your equipment at this price point.
And to interject, Johan is extremely greedy. He's the only one that rides with his brakes backwards. So he can choose a bike, and then none of us want that bike, because we will actually die through no fault of the bike. Just set up.
Yeah, that's why I ride my front brake on the right side. Mm-hmm. You know, the right hand and the right side. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
What was your take, Johnny?
Well, just kind of on what they were saying, it's funny thinking back to like my first mountain bike where, yeah, you would break something every ride. I think I remember going to North Star on my first bike with a dual crown fork, and it was a quick release dual crown fork. And I went from an XT hub to an LX hub to a Dior hub to a just Shimano brand hub, because I think my parents realized like these relacing wheels is getting really expensive, or, you know, all these axles we're replacing is getting pretty expensive. And then eventually I got 888 and it was awesome. But yeah, I think it is cool how these all, you're not really losing anything in terms of like the frame and geometry. You're getting a foundation that you can like really build on. And even with where they come, yeah, it's like you don't break a hub every time you ride. I think because I know everyone else has to ride it, I'm limiting myself to just be like, all right, let's not blow out these wheels right away, or try not to burn through the brake pads entirely. It's a balancing act for sure on the cheap bike. But it was surprising because, yeah, once you're kind of adjusted to, or like recalibrated to like what the entry level components are going to do, you can just ride it the way you normally would. But you just kind of know like the limit is going to get, you're going to get to the limit a lot quicker on it. But if you're kind of like holding yourself back, then yeah, I mean, they all ride really good. And I think for me, it was kind of like put myself in the shoes of someone who's realistically going to buy this bike. I don't think someone that's been riding for 20 or 25 years is going to be like, all right, my next one's going to be the $2,000 bike. And when you look at it from that perspective, I think, yeah, like that entry-level experience is so much better, because say you got one of those bikes 20 years ago and you break apart every ride, you're going to get out of the sport pretty quickly, realizing how expensive it is. Kind of like you said earlier, Johan, where it's like, you really had to want it past a point of just like getting a bike. It was like getting off the ground every time you crash, and then getting new parts every time you ride damn near. Because mm-hmm. Yeah, the same way I'd break front hubs, I'd break derailleurs, and I went from XT all the way down to Dior on that end too. And you're just, yeah, kind of bummed. Like, man, I had a really nice bike. And yeah.
And yeah, I believe that I come from the trail perspective where, you know, myself and our company Momentum, we built everything from a really beginner intro trail up into World Cup racetracks and national champs. And, you know, the pro end of the spectrum, they sometimes complain this is boring, not big enough, or this is too fast or too dangerous, all of the above. But beginners, they typically say like, really, I can do that? I'm like, yeah, here, check this out. You can roll this way, hold the bar straight, look ahead, and you can roll over this. You know, and so from that perspective of, hey, you know, person A or B, you can roll off this curb, look what this bike can do. And they all have dropper posts now. Now, like, you can push this lever and the seat goes down. They're like, whoa, no one cares how many speeds it is. You know, you can push this lever and the seat goes down. Like, whoa, this is amazing. And I think that's easy to forget. But yeah, from the perspective of, yeah, you can roll over this rock and the bars will stay straight and the tires don't flat. We had no flats today, right? Like, that was pretty cool. And to show someone coming into the sport, like, you can get this bike, seat post drops, roll over almost anything. That's super cool. That didn't happen before.
For sure not.
Yeah. Got any thoughts, Jay? Son? Go ahead, Nils.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people kind of underestimate what those bikes can do, because they'll bring you about 80% to where you want to be with a bike as someone who is quite experienced, and like comparing it to a $10,000 bike, those extra $7,500 or so will just give that extra 20%. And so there's so much you can do. And I guess like the crowd that buys that kind of bike isn't the real most experienced. And so for that kind of crowd, you can really go really, really far with those bikes. And there's, you know, throughout the day, I guess all of us had kind of the same weak spots. And actually, they're not that massive because we mostly complained about brakes or tires. And those are a pretty easy swap. And if you swap those two things, you can really shred those bikes. And they have no weak point. They won't break, as you said. And it's just great, really. You can have a lot of good time on them.
Yeah. Since it kind of seems like, for the most part, this is a test on the spec provided for the price, for the most part. When I was building them up, it was interesting to see what seemed like product managers or whoever's behind the spec of the bike at a particular company, if they were trying to make the bike cheap or trying to make it kind of ride better. Like some are dual 180 rotors, some had 200 mil rotors. Just there are little things on the bike that it seemed like there was a little bit more thought into how some of the bikes were built. Would you guys say that's accurate? Like, I don't know what it takes to be a brand manager or product manager or whatever and spec a bike, but some are going for price over performance.
One thing that I think is not a price increase or decrease, like on the Specialized, they had T9 rubber in front, which is awesome and grips super well. T7 rubber in the back, rolls a little faster. That's what I ride on my bike. And that's not a price increase or decrease. You know, that's like really smart product spec. I think that's super cool.
They also had 200 millimeter rotors. Like, hello, this is a 140, mm-hmm. 150 millimeter bike. Just because you're building it cheap, you don't need to put 180 rotors or very cheap 180 rotors that have a glazed over braking surface. We had a couple of those today that barely worked even by the end of the day after quite a lot of elevation. So yeah, shout out to any product managers listening. Some of you could be a bit smarter with the choices while sticking to the budget. It's not necessarily the same, going cheap and going with a small rotor or whatever. A lot of attention could be paid to how the bikes are built out of the box. You know, the control sat in the wrong spots almost on all of them. And of course, you have to take the grips off because these don't have hinged clamps or whatever. But, put them in the right order. And nobody rides with their shifter and dropper post lever perch sitting between the grip and the brake levers. Like, why would it sit there? Just put it on the other side from the factory and save all these poor beginners the 6 months of riding it the wrong way that they're inevitably going to be doing before they figure it out and go like, hey, that can go on the right side. Oh, that's way better, you know? So those are little things to look out for, but they're not deal breakers and they don't change your purchasing decision. But it was interesting to see. Yeah.
Yeah. Rick. So Rick Reed, what's your title with Sky Tavern?
I'm still asking that same question too. Okay. So I think, you know, head of bike park development, we're a small nonprofit. So I think if it falls under bike, it's my problem to deal with.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've been on plenty of press camps and plenty of bike tests for us that, you know, involve $8,000-$10,000 bikes. And you slung leg over some of these and seemed like you had fun. And you're riding in an environment that you know really well, because you're helping develop this park so anyone can come out and ride a bike, but shredders can still have fun too. Like, were you surprised at how the bikes could perform out there?
Absolutely. And I think it expanded my perspective and put me in the saddle and on the pedals of someone who might come in with a lot less experience than what, you know, we're all used to there with riding and the gear that we have. And we're fortunate to have all that. But I was... like some discussions here already, we've talked about, you know, comparing to the past. I was trying to compare in present time in my head and thinking, you know, I was back to what you just said about, you know, riding $10,000 bikes and at media camp. So we still argue over tire spec on $10,000 bikes too. And there's a bike, you know, maybe a bike in my garage now that I wonder why it was spec'd with a certain compound or, you know. So I don't think that even the price matters, that we still have those discussions at every price point across mountain biking. And again, even those base base components are a lot better than they were years ago, to go back in the past and make that comparison. But for here at the at Sky Tavern and what we're doing this test, I was just surprised at, you know, how much fun I could have on a bike that is on sale for $2,250 right now compared to what I'm able to ride on a daily basis. And I still felt that, you know, I'm not having to adjust my riding style that much necessarily. And yeah, you might have to keep in mind that the brakes won't stop you as quickly as you're used to or something like that. And one day is not a long-term test, but it was rad to see, you know, to have fun on the trail that I've ridden 1,000 times, thanks to what Steve's built there, that I want to ride it that many times, you know, and I can still have just as much fun on a budget bike and feel like I'm not really gambling so much. Like, you know, within reason, I think, you know, we can push maybe 80% on that first day today of what we might normally ride, but across the jumps and everything, like, I'm having just as much fun. And that's what's cool. Like, I don't need to think back in time. I just think that, you know, any rider can come in on one of these bikes that we rode today, and when they have the skills to, you know, ride the terrain that we tested on today, I don't think they're going to be let down. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. To be fair, Rick thought we should call the test before we rode the bikes, gambling in Reno with cheap bikes.
Absolutely. You know, and at least today, I think the gamble paid off. I think we won, you know. We all had fun. We didn't break anything. And like Johnny said, you're keeping in mind that everyone has to ride the bikes for a couple of days and we're maybe not pushing super hard, but man,
I had a good time last year making fun of Rick because he had, I believe, a GX derailleur, and he asked me, like, how does this ship, this isn't working. I'm like, well, the XO derailleur is specifically much better, like it's a tighter fit, you know, everything works better. And he upgraded his derailleur finally, and then he's like, oh my god, this is amazing, GX is unrideable. And today you were on NX.
It was even an SX, yeah. And yeah, that's a really good point. And
but we didn't lose chains really, and that totally happened before. You know, historically we'd be on 3-ring setups, and I think that's terrible for a beginner. Like, here, look, this left hand, the thumb paddle makes it go harder. On your right hand, the thumb paddle makes it go easier. Yeah. Don't mess them up,
right?
You know, you're gonna lose your chain and lose your teeth. Uh-huh. And now it's just one shift. So I think it just, like, furthers my beliefs that biking's better and simpler. And I actually want to hear your perspective on, like, shoes and products, because that's the world you came from, right? And, like, 10 years ago, there was only a 510 shoe that was viable. And now there's so much more stuff, from shoes to products, and, like, it all works.
Most of it works.
Most of it works, yeah.
Yeah. You know... There might still be some room to, you know, just because you make a product and it's in your catalog doesn't necessarily mean that maybe you should make that product and have it in your catalog. I think that that's part of the issue that this industry's in right now, is that it's a great time to be a mountain biker, but from certain aspects of this industry, it's not the greatest time. And there's been some unfortunate things happening lately, and you know, people that aren't in the, you know, high level decision making positions are at the brunt of those decisions that have been made that aren't so great. That there's, you know, there's way too much product inventory. There's too much of this, you know, strive for consumerism and, you know, buy this. Our company needs to sell this, needs to sell that. But do they? You know, like, does every brand that makes gear need to have a SKU in their catalog for every protective category? Or, you know, does every brand need to make a helmet just because they make some such sort of apparel? And I think that people need to step back in those positions and you know, reanalyze and say, like, is, you know, are we trying to be everything, or can we focus on something? And back to that conversation of, like, you know, who's a good product manager and brand manager for a bike, I think the ones that can realize and say, hey, you know, I want the best rider experience for our rider, for our brand, and then have that follow through the entire product development line and right to the, you know, to the shipping and boxing and how the consumer gets the bike, then they're the ones that are, they're going to stick around, hopefully, because they're going to have that best added value to the end consumer. And, you know, that's what's still lacking in some parts of the bike world and in the gear and everything. And, you know, Johan knows, I mean, he tests more gear than any of us. And, you know, I think you probably could say that there's maybe some things that aren't necessarily as reliable as what we rode on bikes today.
Yeah, if you're kind of a beginner or less experienced mountain biker getting into the sport today, first thing you should do is definitely shop around, because when it comes not just to bikes, but the equipment in general, because so much of it has gotten so much better, and there's a lot of really, really positive innovation out there. If you look at fabrics and stuff that goes into what we wear, if you, any of you go back 15 years in time and take out, you know, if you've saved any of your wardrobe items, you wouldn't want to be caught dead in that today. First of all, you know, the colors or whatever the designer was on at the time, not a good look. And also just the fabrics themselves, they were horrible. After half an hour of riding, you know, you'd smell like a skunk that's been run over. And that's just not the case today. You know, you can get dry release stuff or whatever, things that doesn't, you don't have to feel like you're riding around in a nylon garbage bag recycled as a jersey, you know. So that's the good stuff is out there, but very much to your point, Rick, there's still brands putting out equipment that you wonder if they ever rode it once they, you know, designed it. It probably came out of some CAD/CAM software, went off to Asia, came out of the production line, and they went, yep, this is good, put it on the shelves. And then, you know, a couple of rides in, you're like, hey, did anybody ride in this after they designed it?
And I know that happens. That absolutely happens. Come on, and it shouldn't.
Throw a bone. Give me an example of one you think is like that.
No, that would be unfair. But come, you know, we were talking about shoes, right? And how 510 was like the one that the only one you could ride. And if you go back 10 years in time, that was absolutely the case. If you were a serious rider on flat pedals, if you weren't wearing a shoe with stealth rubber, you were literally just giving away whatever it is, time or
it's
points.
Just a shoe.
Without stealth rubber, it's just a shoe, man. So
I'll jump in on that one, because yeah, 510 used to be the only one. Like, Specialized has good rubber now in their shoes. Fox does too.
Those are the three, by the way. You can stop there.
Yeah.
You can stop there.
But I tried a Teva before, and I'm like, oh, that just feels like the rubber that should be on a skateboard. These are terrible. And I've done work for some different brands before. They're like, oh, but this is a good shoe. I'm like, I do not care. I will wear a sandal with good rubber over a very good shoe with terrible rubber.
Absolutely. And they've all been I've been through all of them. I've pretty much ridden all the flat pedal shoes. Mm-hmm. And up until Specialized came in with the third generation Slipknot stuff, before, it was always the same story. I'd get a shoe. It would always be awesome. It would be way more awesome than the 510. It might even have BOA or some new fancy construction method or whatever it was. They always fit really nice. They had all the bells and whistles. You put them on the pedal and go, nope. If it rains even a little bit, or if I'm headed in, you know, a gnarly trail that I don't know, I don't want to wear this shoe. Like, I literally don't want to wear it. And so I would always come back to this. Okay, well, it's 510. And then that changed. Specialized nailed it. And Fox has nailed it. So like that opens it up for the rest of it. But the story would always be the same, and it's still the same today. I still get super awesome shoes that I won't ride in.
Well, in the world of sandals, I think Ride Concepts nailed the sandal with good rubber.
Oh yeah, that was the best one for sure.
They're legit.
Yeah, that one's legit. Yeah. The what was it called again?
Coaster.
Thank you. Yes,
they're literal shoes that they're dedicated mountain biking shoes that are literally a bit more dangerous to ride than just Vans. I've seen those that we literally went back home because we almost died in the rain riding them, right? So yeah, brands, just do your own
homework.
Do your homework. Yeah, go ride your stuff.
Do your homework.
You'll figure out a thing or two.
It'll be interesting to see if the apparent slowdown of stuff kind of thins the herd here.
It's inevitable. I mean, this happened in the snowboard world. It's going to have to happen here. It's going to have to happen in all of outdoor. It's not just cycling. It's not just mountain biking. The outdoor industry as a whole needs to stop and look at what is the end game here, and what's the big picture long-term goal.
Yeah, we could be on like $5,000 bikes next year for the budget test with all the blowout sales and stuff. It could trickle all the way down to that.
Yeah, like they're $5,000 now, and next year they'll be...
Yeah, it'll be under $3,000 next year.
That's true.
Yeah, I one cool thing about the accessibility of the sport is I think there are more trails of all types now. I think some of the built manufactured trails get more press now, or they're more visible. But I believe that I see more rogue trails and more professionally built trails everywhere. You know, and I think it's pretty easy to find a lot of them. And I think that's really cool. You know, it's awesome to see people starting out for the first time, and you can see someone who pedals squares, you know, more or less, and they're nervous. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. They're trying it. And I'm like, wow. And I think that's awesome, you know? So it's, I think that's everywhere, but you know, I obviously go places where people are hiring us to build, but like, what do you, you're in, San Diego, Jason, and there's lots of rogue trails. Are there,
you got that out?
Yeah. Like, what do you see?
Rogue podcast.
I have mic options. Yes, there's more trails now than 10 years ago when I was first getting into mountain biking. There's also a lot more, there's a lot more ways to find trails, both, I mean, trail forks, or I mean, you can still go to your local bike shop if you want and probably get cool guide about like, yeah, you should ride this spot, but really the good spot's over there. But there's just a lot more knowledge on trail stuff. But I feel like everyone's been crushing it with this conversation. Like, I've been listening and it's awesome. But it's kind of like, what's the saying? Like, rising tides raise all ships. It's that for me. Like, going back to Rampage, Rampage gets more eyes on mountain biking. And the more eyes that are on it, you know, my family in Kentucky, my grandma will send me something from Rampage and be like, you seen these mountain bike guys? I'm like, yeah, like that was from 2013. It's crazy. Yeah. You know, but like, but it's hitting, it's relevant outside of our core industry that we know, which is super, we're like kind of narrow-minded in the way we see mountain biking. But then, you know, the bikes are getting better. There's more access to trails. Growing up in San Diego, I was one of three kids that rode mountain bikes. Everybody else surfed and skated. I know like probably 15 kids since then that have hit me up. They're like, hey, like I want to get a mountain bike. Like, what should I get? Because they live near trails, or, you know, they realize that they can get bikes now that are good at a lower price. Like just all maybe like barrier to entry, maybe across the board is a lot better. Even products. I mean, I proved everybody wrong today that you don't need any of these shoes you guys are talking about. Good old Vans will take you far. They might eliminate some toes along the way, but, you know, like part of me, you know, I think back to like when I first started riding, yeah, the gear and stuff's all cool, but like you can get it nowadays, you can get a good helmet that's safe for cheap, which is awesome. You don't need any of their shit. Like, I ride in a cotton tee all the time because, like, I think most bike gear looks freaking kooky. But, like, it's personal, you know? Like, I like skating and snowboarding and surfing. And, like, mountain biking will always look different. But, like, you can look however you want, and there's bikes out there that give you an experience that's so much better than all of ours sitting here when we first got into it. I think that's why we're all still so passionate about it, is we went through different steps to be where we are now, like whether it's the bikes breaking or the terrible gear that's too hot or riding fire roads because there aren't any trails or whatever that might be. Like, it is a great time to get into it kind of across the board. I mean, and yeah, between you can go on vitalintobe.com and learn all about all kinds of stuff. You can go on YouTube and watch freaking Jeff Kendallweed teach you how to wheelie or something, you know, like it's kind of endless, the info that's out there. Which, yeah, I don't know. Bit of a ramble because everybody else is crushing it covering about cheap bikes. You know, the question that kept coming to me is we're all sort of like faffing, high-fiving about how sick these cheap bikes are, but we all ride really expensive bikes. So like, are we all going to start riding $3,000 mountain bikes? Like, what if we're all super stoked on what these bikes can provide and the on-trail experience and the performance level they hit? Why aren't we going to go out and buy those? What's maybe like, if people are looking at these and we know what maybe Halo product experience is, what's that difference and what should they look at changing on their bike as they progress as a rider to maybe get, need to be riding a nicer bike?
Well, first of all, you said a few keywords in there, like you're a mountain bike journalist and you're talking about buying a bike. Like, you've lost it. That's like way beside the point. Well, the reason we all have $10,000 bikes is somebody sent them
fair
to
enough
us
though
and all the gear
I,
and all
I
this
don't
stuff.
Actually, since I've been at Vital, I've never owned a mountain bike.
Yeah,
I mean, I bought my road bike I currently own, I bought my dirt jumper I own, and outside of this job, yeah, I mean, I live in San Diego, we do have great mountain biking, but like I have the most fun riding
around the streets and hitting jumps and airtime. Like, I've been riding mountain bikes a long time, and like, if I want to ride mountain bikes, I'm going to travel to a destination that offers the experience I'm after. Like, yeah. But yes, I would happily buy a bike to like fit what I need. And I think, like, I mean, for me personally, I'm not going to go buy a super nice bike. I would happily buy an aluminum bike. I like the feel of aluminum better. And then I would get nice brakes. I would get mid-level suspension and tires and wheels that I enjoy. Maybe not nice, but I mean, good tires, but probably wheels that have a good warranty or I know are durable, a mid-level drivetrain. And that's it, because like, I want a bike that I can destroy and like throw around. And you know, the fancy stuff is really cool. I would put electronic shifting on it. I love electronic shifting. It's the fucking best.
Everything you just described though is like what Neil said, that's the 20% difference. Like, the bike would get you 80% of the way there, and that's like the 20%. And
I think I rely on my experience and abilities for my like 10 extra percent. Yeah. I'm not going for 100% anymore.
So. Yeah, and like historically I'd always buy a used bike for around $2,800 that's like a slightly nicer build spec and upgrade the wheels, maybe put a different damper in the fork, and it's good to go. Like, it's usually just wheels are the shortcoming generally. And I think because we went through all those like shortcomings of other bikes, you know, we don't need the $10,000 bike, but obviously we have access to them. And I think it just makes it to where it's like, I'm not giving this thing up. Like, I appreciate all these things. This is really nice. You don't need it, but it's really nice.
Yeah, no, I'm ready to give it up, the, you know, the extra 20%. But not in the geo department. Like, I'm super picky with the numbers, and I'll buy a bike that I, for the specific riding that I want to do with it. Yeah. I'm very, very picky, because the last, let's say, 3 or 4 years, they've really nailed a few of the key points that make a difference compared to even 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. You know, a steeper seat tube, the head angle in the right ballpark. Like, it needs to be exactly where I want it. The amount of travel, less maybe picky about chainstay length specifically, but like that total package, the way it puts me where it puts me on the bike where I want to be, I'll be super picky on that. And then if I have to downgrade a fork or a shock, no, I don't. Somebody will send me some really nice stuff, and I'll just put it back on there. So I'll start out with like a nice mid-level build, and then DHL will show up and be like, "Hey, here's the $1,200 shock and $1,800 fork that you should be testing," and then that will just stay there. Yeah, that's how that's gonna go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a cool takeaway for probably all of us today, but definitely me, was that all the bikes we were on, frame, geo, and a lot of like suspension kinematics, like we really didn't, nobody had beef with that. We were talking most about components, and like, that's really great for, I think it was sort of said already, but like, people that buy these bikes, they have the chance, they're basically riding the same bike that the nicer spec is, and then they have the opportunity to upgrade components where it fits their needs. Because, you know, we might have complained about some of the tires today, but depending on where you ride, those tires might match your terrain perfectly. And even with, I mean, brakes a little bit, like, if you're really getting into the sport and you're riding mellower terrain, a lot of those Tektor brakes might be okay. I mean, we were all like going fast.
At a point, you don't want it to be too touchy.
100%.
When you're just starting out.
100%.
And there was one cool part of the day today where I feel like mountain biking is the same no matter what bike you're on, where we were all looking at this one rock art, and there's a line here, there's a line there, there's a line over here, and you can also jump this one rock over here. And Rick's done this line before, and he's like, "Wow, that's sketch. I don't want to do that. That's super gnarly." And I was like, okay, is my tire hard enough to not fold over? And like, very specifically to the point of like, what's the difference in a less expensive bike and a higher end bike? The front tire on the Rocky, I believe it was a WTB, it was slightly overinflated on purpose so it wouldn't fold. I didn't get the choice of traction and stability, but I was like, okay, this won't fold on me. It's not going to kill me. So like, I can do this line. It's like kind of blind, kind of sketch, kind of whatever, but I was like, that's okay. I can still do this line, and the turn is imperfect. I feel like with the super high-end bikes, you get the best of both worlds. But for me, I could only get one of them, and I chose life.
Well,
I chose life, not speed. And that's like the real world difference.
Well, and I think a lot of people getting into mountain biking, they don't know that you have the choice of traction versus stability. You know, you learn that in time, and they might, before they even get to that point, be like, I can't freaking stop, because they're riding at ability, that they're two-finger braking and dragging brake all the time for like the safety that provides, where, you know, we all of us here have different preferences on like what we prioritize in a bike, but we've learned that through like years of riding bicycles, maybe not even different bikes really, but like you can ride the same bike for a long time and learn what you might want and not like out of it. And even going to talking about, you know, being so lucky to ride really nice bikes, I've yet to ride the highest end bike from any brand and be like, man, they did it. We're done. We're at the end.
Perfect.
I'm always like, how, like, transmission, I'm like, it's super good. Still shifts bad once every so many times. It's not perfect. Or like, you know, I still flat. I still brake wheels. Brakes that I'm like, I just bled this the other day and I need to like bleed it again. And
you don't bother checking sag.
I don't check sag, but as you can tell, it's got me pretty far.
I already got my hands full with all these brake stuff.
All this other stuff that I just don't like. No, but like, you know, it's getting nitpicky. And of course, like the ride experience is great. But to me today, because I haven't ridden a bike like that in so long, I was like, oh wow, we're a lot closer than in my, I thought we, this whole test, I was like, it's going to be a bloodbath. We're going to be blowing up wheels and like bending crank arms and chain snapping, and nothing was wrong. And towards the end of the day, I was like, well, we're almost at the end of day one. We just got tomorrow to get through. Like, I'll just start pushing it. Like, what's the worst that's going to happen? You know, one bike gets eliminated. So okay.
That's why that section was cool. Cause that one section, there were different lines, different people looking at like, oh, are you going to do that? You're going to try that. And someone did this thing and someone did that thing. And then there was some other guy off in the woods taking pictures. That just sounds like a normal mountain bike ride to me.
Yeah.
You know, you're debating what to do, what should I do, what can I do? And that's the entirety of the fun part of the sport for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And like with the Geo, and going back to me saying, you know, I was like, oh, I got to reel it back a little so I don't break these parts. If you didn't think about breaking parts and just did what you would normally do, it was incredible how you still feel relatively comfortable knowing that the brakes might not slow you down as much, knowing that the wheels might not hold up as well, or knowing that you could flat. If you don't think about any of that, you can do it legitimately. And like, I think it's just crazy that, you know, even trail bikes are capable of that. The frame is stiff enough to hold up through it, and the Geo is good enough to like keep you upright. Whereas, you know, the bikes we started out the discussion talking about, any wrong move and you're going to crash.
Yeah.
And those were like $4,000 bikes, you know,
for sure.
Yeah. And the thing is, the same complaint of parts breaking was brought to light by Dakota Norton and Bruni also in previous, you know, recent podcasts. Like, I can go faster, but my bike won't survive. You know, like, and those guys are some best in the world.
You want to feel like Loic Bruni or Dakota Norton? Buy a $2,000 mountain bike.
Totally. Yeah, that's exactly what I need to do.
But that, now I get it. You know,
I'm like, I can do this.
You don't get that on a $10,000 bike.
No. The $10,000 level is much higher.
When you come from the Halo level down to the entry level consumer grade, you're like, wow, yeah, I would probably break a lot of stuff on this bike if I keep doing this, but it can do it for a finite number of times.
Yeah, and like then, you saw G's bike on his crash where he exploded at Rampage.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how large that drop was, but it was, it's like at 60 least,
feet or
at
something.
60. It was 60?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
And his bike, I thought it exploded and his bike was basically fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Well, in his own words, he was basically fine too. Just, you know, a cracked skull and a couple of vertebrae. But he ride his rein, give it a couple of months. He'll be back.
Never trust the words from someone who just cracked their skull. but no, I feel like the bike survived. Like, sure, he's abnormal. He has more metal in his body than most people. But the bike survived that? That's crazy.
Yeah, and a lot of these frames wouldn't maybe do that, but what they can do is, like, I mean, you could probably drop off your house. I mean, I'm not saying you should, but you probably could drop off of, like,
tomorrow's
house,
test.
You know?
The Rossignol's pretty heavy. It might survive.
It's got some mass there.
Yeah.
But they're all, like, very similar construction to what the top-of-the-line aluminum bike is. It's the same frame, I believe, on all of them, and it's, like, if you swap out the parts, you're basically on the top of the line bike at that point. Like Geo is going to be the same more or less, and the stiffness of it will be similar. And I think that's the cool part, is you're not like all that technology it took so long to develop from our first mountain bikes to now is available to someone's first mountain bike, like full suspension bike. And you're just going to sacrifice some weight and then maybe some durability long term. But generally, the heavier parts are more durable.
Yeah. Going back to Johan, you mentioned like how the bikes are assembled, where the controls are, the cockpit. And Steve, you talked about a little bit on the trail today. Some of the bikes we have are direct to consumer. Some you have to buy at a bike shop. And, you know, building them, I'm like, yeah, direct to consumer, sweet, set it up. But Steve, you raised a really good point that it seemed like almost, if it's a first timer, beginner, the value of getting a bike built or fit at a bike shop to make sure some of these things that we know are kooky, like where the controls are placed, is communicated to the person with the bike.
Yeah, I feel like it's pretty important to have. I think the shops are awesome. If you have some amazing friend who's going to help you set up everything, you know, that's cool too. But if you can go to a good shop that sells the bike or sets it up, and they can, you know, just make sure that the brake reach is good and your suspension is set up pretty well, like, that's awesome. You don't really get that with direct to consumer. And I feel like every shop out there should totally embrace direct to consumer bikes, because that's going to be their future customer with service, upgrades, all that. But I do think there's a value to go to a shop and say, like, hey, I want to get into this. Like, what should I look out for? Can I make this lighter or heavier? And I think that's awesome, you know, just to make sure it fits and make sure you're comfortable. And for those beginners, really know how the dropper works and say, like, yeah, I want my brakes to be really strong, or I don't want it to be too touchy. Yeah. You know, either one's fine, but a really good shop can do that. So I think shops are worth it.
For everyone that's worked at a bike shop, would you bed in the brakes? Because that's the first thing you notice is when, okay, the bike's built, let's go. You ride down the street and you honk on the brakes. You don't stop at all. Like if,
yeah,
if someone just spent $2,000 on a bike and they ride down the street and don't stop, like, do shops do that?
I think it's down to whoever's like running their service department or whoever owns the shop. But yeah, every shop I've worked at, bed in the brakes for sure.
Okay.
And then if someone's buying a bike, you generally set it up for them. But yeah, like with the consumer direct brands, I think it'd be good to just like suggest a safety check from a bike shop, because the bike company can only do so much. They can give you an owner's manual, they can give you a toolkit, but it almost needs to be like a link in an email, like, hey, here's your owner's manual, by the way, like, suggest a safety check at your local bike shop, and have local bike shops support that, to where it's like, yeah, give us 25 or 40 bucks or something, and we'll essentially look over your whole bike and make sure that you actually did this right. And like, oh yeah, you actually can adjust the reach on the brakes, and oh yeah, your quick release shouldn't be against the fork leg, it should be vertical, like stuff like that, where, yeah, I think a lot of shops should, if they don't require people to bed in brakes, do that.
And another point here, if we're talking about people getting into the sport these days, it's become a lot more commonplace, but it didn't used to be back in the day, is actually get some skills coaching, because if you can save so much time and pain and heartache by just having somebody in the shop set up your bike and then go out on the trail with somebody who knows how to teach you the basic stuff, like body position, weight transfers, real simple stuff. Not, you don't have to get flashy with it. But so many people will go like, oh yeah, I have trouble going off drops, I probably need a factory level fork. No, you don't. You need to just time your body weight transfer, and you could do it on any bike. You could do it without suspension, literally. So no, that's something that maybe isn't mainstream yet. If you look at the ski industry, for example, like if you go once a year on a ski vacation, the first thing everybody does for the whole family is get ski lessons, right? Because otherwise you're just going to end up in the local hospital and then vacation is ruined. That's what you do to learn to ski. It's like an obvious thing. So many people I still speak to in mountain biking, they've been riding for 10 years. And I'm like, hey, did you ever take a lesson? No way, man. I've been riding for 10 years. You've been doing the wrong thing for 10 years. That's now impossible to correct. And it didn't make you any better doing the wrong thing for 10 years. You should, if you would have just done it right from the beginning, you would have been way more awesome now. And well, yeah,
unlike the ski trip, their whole family is not watching.
Yeah,
yeah. Actually, as of someone who kind of knows how to ride a bike, I can tell you that one of the best biking lessons I've ever gotten with a very famous coach was basic foot placement on my pedal. That has changed my riding forever. And it, as stupid as it sounds, just get back to the roots and the basics, and that can impact. Like 90% of the riders haven't done that ever, and they really, really should.
Yeah, and one thing that we often ask with the basic bike test is, what would you change with, what, $100, $200 for this bike?
It was like $200 last time.
Similar question. I firmly believe that it's worth getting the cheapest bike if money is really an issue. If it's a difference between $2,000 and $2,500, I believe someone will have a much better cycling experience with a $2,000 bike and 100 pair of shoes that are made for biking and $200 worth of lessons twice.
Yep.
You know, that mm-hmm. person will be a better rider, a safer rider, and have more fun on the cheaper bike.
Yeah.
Yep.
Rick, you're all about the lessons.
Yeah, I mean, just from my own experience at Sky Tavern this year, we started our clinic program, Riders in the Sky, and we were lucky to get some amazing coaches this year and who are going to expand this program in the future. And but we came into this thinking like, okay, again, like back to that ski area concept, in the winter, that's what Sky Tavern is. It's all about teaching kids to ski. So we, in the summer, you know, you want to replicate that, but also make it work for mountain biking and adapt it to that. And we didn't know coming into it exactly what the demand would be. It's like, you know, obviously there's a lot of riders in the Reno Tahoe region. But you know, even some of our coaches were a little bit questionable on like, hey, you know, I don't know, are there enough women to fill a women's class? Are there enough kids that are going to come out every week? And we quickly learned, we got the word out there a little bit, and the demand is high. And we're just so excited that we can take that momentum in the next year and have more classes. And this year we focused a lot on youth and women inclusive and did a couple men's clinics. And next year we'll be able to expand everything. But it was really cool. And back to, you know, what Neil said, I mean, just to see how our coaches break down the fundamentals, whether that's a true beginner, someone who's only been out a few times, or even an intermediate rider. So many people have never had that fundamental coaching, and it's just, you see, you know, in a 3-hour class where they start and then how they come out of that class and the things they've done during that class that have blown them away mm-hmm. and been like, I never thought I was going to do this ever. I saw this feature before. It never even entered my mind. And our coaches were able to break down the fundamentals in the early part of the class and work them up. And suddenly they're going over these, you know, rocks and features on the trails that they never had the concept of and had never, you know, been able to imagine doing it. And that's what's really exciting to see. And it's...
I learned some coaching when I was 14, 15, and I ruined wheels. You know, I had no concept of line choice. And then my parents were like, we weren't, you know, affluent or poverty or anything. We're kind of in the middle. They're like, hey, we can't just buy you wheels. You know, like I had to learn how to relace my own wheels, and I'm grateful for that now. But I also like learned line choice through ruined parts, and I learned coaching through some coaches before, but God, it was hard to find, you know, and now it is way more accessible. I think it's easier to find. And I wish it was more like skiing where you do the bunny slope. You do a coach, do this, but now it's like, I rode a bike. I'm like, oh God, oh no. Like
it's
you're gonna get ruined. No, yeah. Please take a lesson.
It is pretty funny. We're so used to the way it's been and like, oh well, mountain biking's different. You just go and you know, it doesn't really make sense. And we're really, you know, trying to make these classes more accessible. Being a nonprofit, we were able to get grants and make the pricing extremely affordable to the community. And I think that's really crucial. That you know, we're just able to offer something at a good price that has a lot of value. And our coaches say like, hey, you don't have to skin your arms up to learn. You don't have to skin your knees constantly to learn the right way, that we can teach you the right fundamentals. And even this season, we're on a great track record of, you know, everybody came out of the classes unscathed until the last two classes. So we had small injuries. But yeah, But it's a testament, I think, to the coaching straight up, is that like if a skilled professional coach can show you the right moves, what to do, what not to do, break it down in the right way, you can understand it, and you start in the parking lot. Like, you literally start in the parking lot, and that's your first 45 minutes of the class, and then you take it to the trail, and yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right to the pump track and then the trails. It's really just fun to watch that happen in real time. And you see the progress within a couple of hours. And, you know, what we were able to do to today and test these budget bikes in the same scenario, just, you know, try to make me feel more into the bike shoes, hopefully quality bike shoes of those people taking the classes and riding the trails that are not on crazy expensive bikes and whatnot, and be like, yeah, this is great. This is great for everyone. And it's true that trails and bikes can be great for everyone.
Do you feel like you could find, or you could have success with durability and performance in a full suspension mountain bike that's cheaper than what we rode today?
No.
Yeah, that's going to be a no.
Probably not. I was reprimanded because I didn't say a one-word answer previously.
That's your chance.
This is my chance.
Go, Steve, go.
No, because it's...
Come on, Steve.
In the Rock Garden example, I was like, I chose durability and with higher tire pressure over performance. You know, so with a cheaper bike, I don't believe you're going to be able to do some of the stuff we did today over the long run. I believe it will have a... It'll be detrimental to the health of the bike, possibly the rider.
First of all, if there are any cheaper and worse performing brake rotors out there, I do not want to know about it. Please don't write in. Don't tell us which they are. We don't want to test them. I don't want to know.
Cheap gear show?
Oh, yeah. Oh, budget gear show.
Gear show is Gucci, man.
Only the
Gucci
best.
Gear show? Yeah. I kind of think about what you were just talking about a minute ago, though. Like, if you are tight on money and the difference between a $2,000 bike and a $2,500 bike is something as a deciding factor to take that money and, you know, do the shoes or the helmet and the lessons or whatever it is, like, I would need to go look at the bikes you rode today, because let's say the frame remains the same. So you have the potential to upgrade parts down the line, and you are getting into it where you don't have the knowledge of, oh my God, this brake, this tire, I have to run with a bunch of air for like durability, and then I lose traction. Like, you don't even know that that's what you're going to be looking for on trail. You're like just trying to like you're like just trying to hit the trails with all your other friends that are mountain bikers or whatever it might be. That's where I'm like, maybe, because I don't know. When we looked at these bikes, we were looking for sub 3K. I didn't look at sub 2K. And I don't actually know how many of the bikes we rode we are on lowest model or lowest option. There probably is one tier below. And I don't disagree that the tier below, you're going to lose probably most of the performance that we were like barely grasping onto today with the components we did ride. It would be a much different experience. But the thing that all kind of comes back to the like, I would hope that you would still get the frame that would take you a lot of the way to a good experience. And if it still has a dropper, that's huge. Even if, you know, the brakes can't stop you that well and the suspension's limiting and the tire's limiting, like, you'll figure it out. But if it gets you on the trail, maybe, like, that's, I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it's, yeah, it's kind of a here or there. I think it could go either way for me. Yeah. I think there's, shout out to the kids on the street of the Airbnb we're staying at, because they're doing the classic, like, put a can or a water bottle on your front wheel or rear wheel and you ride. It sounds like a motorcycle.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh.
It sounds like the RPMs are going up.
That's what went by. Yeah, it was a kid cooking down the street.
It's dark outside and they're still at it.
Dude, yeah.
Kids are all right.
Friday. Yeah, the kids are all right.
Well, yeah, and that's why, like, I don't want to have a super jaded perspective, because we're on our budget bike tests. And they're six bikes, $2,500 each, $15,000 worth of bikes, right? And
one Levo SL.
And one Levo SL.
And then that's the price.
For the price of the
stuff. Oh, yeah, totally. No. Like, that's crazy. That's more than some of the cars on the street, you know? So it's still like, yes, it's less expensive than the most, but the kids outside on the street, they're stoked with a plastic bottle, you know, in the tire making different sounds.
$100 bike.
$100 bike. If that. And I think that's the basis of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's talking shit with your friends and jumping off curbs. And I don't think the sport should ever lose that.
Yeah. My very first bike had like a banana seat, and it had a 2-speed internal geared hub in the rear that you would shift by backpedaling, which was also what you did for braking, because it also had a rear hub brake. So every time you wanted to shift gears, you had to brake.
Is that why you were backpedaling today at all times?
No, that's why I was so slow. I'm still stuck in that. Yeah, stuck in that mode, man. Yeah. So when you book it down the street in first gear, and then you want to like go as fast as you can and then shift into second, you'd have to first slow down, and then you could go again.
Oh, that's amazing.
Are we cheap biked out? Is there more to talk about?
This is a very fun conversation. And yeah. I think everybody had great insight to everything. Yeah. And, the state of mountain bikes seems greater than ever, especially if we're looking at through the lens of somebody just getting into it.
Sure. Yeah, the experience today is unprecedented. Amazing. Yeah, yeah.
You can ride everything on one bike that you don't have to blow a ton of money on.
Yeah, Spomer, you asked to like call out some stuff.
Sure.
So today the Rossignol, which I jumped through some stuff, it was like, oh, I'm perfect, and it sounded like a bucket of bolts, but I never lost a chain. Like, if I could choose to race on that 20 years ago, I would choose it in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, like, I didn't flat. I didn't lose my chain with no chain guide.
It has a chain. It has a tiny little one on the front chainring.
Really?
Yep.
Well, you didn't have to
spend an extra washer in it because the way it came spec'd, the little E13 kept spinning. So
I can't believe it sounded as bad as it did, even with that chain guide, but... I was like, I would totally choose that over anything else in the past.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's still like amazingly good.
It was predictable. That's what I think. Yeah. You could trust what it could do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, if we're cheap biked out, I'm going to do a significant rewind to the start and go back to Rampage, because we're all old dudes here talking about brand dogs and raw lines and this and that. But looking on, was it on Instagram, I think, is where I saw it the most, or maybe even on YouTube, tons of people thought BNV got robbed. Like, he was the innovator, and it seemed like they were more like the younger kids, you know? So what do we do? How do we get everyone happy? Solve the problem.
You don't make everyone happy.
The old guys like raw trails. The new kids like front flips.
Well, no, it's not about that. It's a judged sport, and it's always going to be subjective.
Like, who are we trying to make happy? I mean, like, the riders don't think they get paid enough. Everybody watching is upset with who did what. But, like, if we all stand back, we should all be pretty thankful that, like, Rampage exists so that my grandma in Kentucky knows what mountain biking is, which maybe is helping sell more bikes. Like, it's all... I'm not the one to talk on this because I watched half of it and skimmed through it because I was like, maybe we'll do a B practice podcast on it. And I was like, I don't really care about this anymore. Like, it's all super impressive. Like, if we all step back and everyone who's like upset about whatever, like, all these dudes are crazy. They're all gnarly. Like, Bearclaw tried to give perspective on it, but he's from the angle of like, everybody's giving me hate. I'll tell you why I'm right, and here's how we judged it. Which, like, I mean, wouldn't we all feel that way if we were in his shoes a little bit, you know? And it's a flawed judged competition. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, if people that watch Rampage watch any other judge sport, everybody's always upset about everything: surfing, snowboarding, skating, FMX.
I think the issue is,
dude. I mean, if you go watch, what's the thing that everyone does now? The one that happens like in Texas or wherever, where they got like the massive jumps and it's imagination.
Yeah, Red Bull imagination. Yeah.
I think that's what it is. It's always it should have been Colby Raja. It should have been Axel Hodges who won. Like, it doesn't matter. There's people who like the massive front flip over the canyon gap. And then I see Emil do a switch tail up off a drop, and I'm like, that is bananas. But like,
into another drop.
You know, like, yeah, it's all.
Well, I think it's difficult because there's only one Rampage a year, so there's no chance. It's like, you gotta wait till next year. Hope you get invited. hope you build a line that stacks up and then hope you execute it. Whereas like the Fest series and that stuff, no one's complaining about someone not winning a festival.
That's because nobody watches it. Well, they don't produce any media.
Right. Well not anymore. Things, right? Well, no, they pick like a winner. They pick a best whip. They pick best tricks. Same. They pick
a winner. There's not a first through 12.
No, they do award someone like king of the Fest or whatever, or king of the weekend, like that type of stuff. And like no one bitches about that because it's all gnarly. And it's a session.
Yeah, but it's very all weak compared to Rampage because literally it's invite only even for media. And, you know, they produce very little of it compared to how much they put into the build.
It originally had a pretty big buzzer in it. Like there was originally
quite a bit more
content coming out of it and it was a lot more accessible. But yeah, they've kind of backed away from that. But I think that jam session style is cool because it's like, yeah, just ride all day and we'll pick someone. But Red Bull has to be a spectacle. It has to be a live event. It has to be like a story. And
which is great.
Yeah, it is great.
Yeah, it is. And if you look at so many sports and how we measure the people we look up to, like we want these heroes. We want a Michael Jordan. You know, we want the Federers and the Rafa Nadals who just Kelly rack Slater. Up the titles. What?
Kelly Slater.
Oh, yeah. Slater, of course. The GOAT. The OG. the actual GOAT. Yeah. So you want some of that. And then to get to that point where you can just put somebody on a pedestal, you need to have a metric. So what's the metric? It's how many titles how did they score? How did they play? So you want that. And then you see a guy like Brendog who spends, you know, quite a few years showing up at Rampage, digging completely unique lines, taking a lot of risk, keeping it very, very raw. And he does all the things that they said he should do. Have a raw line, have exposure, have risk, go big, try a super sick trick on something that many of them wouldn't even attempt riding. Yeah. And then he has to come down and be fourth again. It's like, at some point, you just want him to be up there.
And that's like, let that dude...
My hero. He's up there and he got that podium. He has that tick in the box. I don't need him to have it because I still think, you know...
Do we not talk about Brendog more now because he did get fourth? And that's, say he got on the podium, do we not still talk about him?
There's a lot of comments online, Brendan, people who care.
But there's people who care in the, like, this is what I think because my opinion matters. It,
that's always the case.
I mean, yes, but like...
That's what the internet gets used for these days.
Yeah, but like, if it's about creating the Jordans or creating the Brendan Fairclaws, like, he did the thing... And regardless of what the six judges put a number on, it still exists.
No, of course. Yeah. And it's the thing I'm pretty much the most stoked on. So,
at the end of the day. Like, I think it's fun. Like, I enjoy kind of, like, talking about it because none of it really matters at the end of the day. Like, Cam won. He's, like, sitting on a beach somewhere right now drinking a mojito. Where the fuck he's doing? Like, it doesn't matter anymore. It's over. Nobody remembers it. Like, that's the world we live in.
Would you guys agree that Brendan won the internet? Brendan, Ollie, and Deacon.
Yeah.
I don't feel like anyone else put out as much as they did as often.
Yeah.
And with such
as awesome.
Yeah, with such a just like personable vibe.
Sure,
like,
absolutely. They're in it for the love of it.
Why
the actual love of it.
Everyone else do that. Like why
he runs a better business.
Sure.
Like this is different, you know. I don't know Van Steenbergen much. Like I don't see a lot of his stuff, but I don't know that it's the story of Brendan got robbed. You know, like, I don't know what his contracts are. I don't know what his income is, you know, but I believe he got eighth at the last one he did, and people said he got robbed. It was totally his choice to come back. You know, so, like, the riders know they have a choice to come back or do other things. And, totally his choice, and he did a lot better, and he's getting a lot of press, and that might be all he needs.
I'm sure, you know, it is. Like, if you know,
he's doing this for his career. And he's talking a lot about Death Grip too. He's like, yeah, I'm doing this. I've been full in on this stuff.
But regardless of that, that crew, they do it for the love of it. If you watch the stuff they put out, they're into it because they actually love being there. They love every minute of it and they're going to do it regardless. Like,
He didn't win the event, but I'm not saying that he lost.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's got his own style of stuff, and I think that's super cool.
With Bienve, too, it's like, he won three awards. Like, he didn't win the event, but he got Best Trick, Rider's Choice, and the Kelly McGaza Spirit Award, and it's like, that's pretty solid accolades if you look at, like, if you were doing it for the sake of building a resume, so to speak, like, that's, I don't know.
And actually, to the point of what it means to those people, if you saw Bienve's reaction after the first run, like, that tells you everything, because he basically didn't even finish his run, broke out in tears, and said, I'm done. I'm never riding that again. And half an hour later, he's like, you know what? I'm stoked to ride. I'm going to go up and do my line again. the front think, flip again. That's like, that's not normal, you know? That's
for me,
not normal.
It was,
and he was always going to do that. He doesn't care.
For me, I thought Talos Turk's run was sick too, because he was another one that like crashed in the little wash at the bottom and they had him mic'd up and he's just like yelling in the helmet. And then he's like, oh, sorry, audio guy.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, like that's just sick, because the whole time he's like going like, chill. Like he's talking to himself. He's like, all right, just chill. And you're like, this nothing about a flip can off of like a 40-foot lip to landing drop is chill, but all right, like yeah,
that's true.
Go slow, maybe.
I'm wondering, what do you guys think about Jackson Riddle and some of the new guys around there? There's some new names. What do you think about them?
Well, I think Jackson's like some of the similar to Brendan. Like, he's doing his thing with, he's got some flair, he's got some style. You don't see him trying a 720 to do it to compete with. Like, Semenuk wasn't there this year, but...
You know, Semenuk was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Semenuk V2.
Totally, yeah. But he's not competing with that. He's doing his own thing, which is, like, his style, which is what he wants. And I think that's cool, you know? He's not doing a run that he believes can win. You know, I don't think he's delusional like that. He's a smart guy, and he's going to do his own style, which is awesome. You know, so like, that's his rampage.
Yeah, but there's only 18 spots there. Should not everybody be trying to win?
That was my take. Like, I watched his run, and on one hand, I like respect him having his own take on rampage. But then that's immediately what I started thinking is like, well, there's probably a lot of people that could watch this and be like, you're kind of just blowing an opportunity. And then I'm like, what's Transition think of this? What's Red Bull think of this? And like,
what does Dark think about it?
Oh my God. Dylan standing in the crowd with a handrail, like, let me in. But I wondered about that too, for sure, because like him and Brage seemed to be, who wasn't there, seemed to be like new free ride a little bit. Like, they're kind of talked a little bit in that sense. And, you know, I don't think Rampage, they don't need Rampage in a way. Yeah. And I think Jackson maybe kind of showed, and who knows, like he could have an injury he's nursing. I know he has like a kid on the way. Like, his headspace could just be like, I'm going to Rampage this year just to be in it and do it. And I'm thankful for that. And
and Rampage runs didn't always have tricks in them, you know.
Well, but like, his was super small. Like, he didn't have tricks, he big gaps, flowing, big drops. Dude. He had nothing.
His, like, scrubs off
the
drops.
Sorry.
Though, those are pretty sick.
We should talk about Ace of Vermette, because he's also up and coming free right out of
suiciding giant cliffs and doing backflips.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does both?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you not see his Instagram post?
Yeah, that was sick.
No,
dude, he suied a giant drop and then flipped.
He does backflips.
Yeah, it was like Reed Boggs' little drop for one of those edits. It's like a.
Did he not? Did he not sui like the old like Ender Gap or whatever it was?
Yeah, yeah,
wait,
yeah.
So
what it was? Exactly. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
It's not okay.
Not okay.
Yeah. he's like 12. He reminds me of Richie Rude. Where like, when Richie Rude was coming up, Richie Rude was like 15 for 10 years. Like, he was good so young that like every year you're like, is he gonna be at World Cups this year? They're like, no, he's 12 now.
Yeah, but I guess who's the best team manager out there? And it might be Nico Malawi, right? Because didn't Nico and Frameworks, they like sign him for a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he signed for 2 more years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like that's like the best.
Talk about building a business for that kid.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Like, for Frameworks. Yeah. Well, for Frameworks. But for Asa, like, Nico's going to have some competition to re-sign him in 2 years, I would think. He might be like, oh, I'm stoked.
That's fine. He's going to get the credit and all the stuff, you know, for the next couple.
And then he'll be on Commensal.
Yeah, they'll just add him to their teams.
It's the nose bikes on him. So.
You know, but like...
easy win.
Like, Ace is amazing. Like, I've seen some stills of him riding. I'm like, that's just odd to see someone's, like, body in that position.
Yeah.
And it's correct, and there's style in there too, and there's like aggressive speed.
You see, like, Purgatory, cool. That video from Purgatory, that was heinous.
Yeah,
that was probably just as big as a drop you hit in Utah.
But like, yeah, I feel like if that guy can, you know, do the free ride thing too.
Yeah,
like, oh,
yeah.
Well, watch what Zink was able to
He's
do.
Got like that. Straight, like Straight was 14 doing Rampage and World Cups, right?
Yeah, and like Asa maybe is more on like the racing end of that spectrum, but
Asa's
thinner build. Isn't everybody?
It's true. No, he's him. I'm sure there's a bunch of kids throughout the world that are in the same age and kind of upbringing as him, but it reminds me of the kids that didn't just grow up riding newer trail bikes and pedaling and trying to race. He like grew up doing that, doing downhill probably, and definitely riding jumps of some kind. Like his skill set is super broad, which like I think back to when I grew up, which is on the tail end way, like I mean this is like probably 2008 for me, so that's definitely tail end of like Cam and Zink coming up, but like it was dirt jumpers and dirt jumps and downhill bikes, and so, like that's what like what you did. And I would say most of my friends that still are athletes now, they look good on a certain way on a bike, they look good on a bike, and like they're fast. And I feel like there's like this new generation of like what's the one kid that his last name is Lawrence, what's his first name, his Ryder. Dad's Randy Lawrence.
Oh, Ryder.
Yeah, like that kid's another one. Like you watch him ride and you're not like, oh yeah, he's just fast, like we'll see what happens in a few years. You're like, oh no, like his body positioning and like the way he sees lines, the way he's approaching everything, you'll see him around for the next decade. There's no way you don't.
And it's also with the junior women too.
Oh my gosh. Like it's with Oscar. It's way more entertaining that there's so many more. Like there's so many up and coming girls that are insane right now in the US. But
yeah, because Oscar, she was second to like Nina Hoffman.
Get near the mic, man.
And, sorry. No, I think it's happening with the men and the women.
Totally.
And it, and I think that's because of some of it's because of accessibility to trails, jumps, all that stuff. Yeah. And you see kids, you know, male, female, everyone really sending it. I'm like, holy cow. Like,
yeah, that's all of it, what you just said, actually. That is the difference.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You pick up one of these cheap bikes. There's all kinds of trails that are already built. There's a lot of people who ride with skill that you can watch and learn from and follow.
Yeah.
And you do that when you're 9 now.
Yeah. And
you know what I mean?
I mean,
yeah, like I follow a lot of transition stuff, but like they're in Bellingham and stuff's going off up there. Like the trails are amazing. They have cool jump lines. And I don't think it's a surprise that their junior team is amazing.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's sure there's the bikes, the people, the managers, but it's also location. Like those locations are awesome. I mean, and that's cool trail centers and trails and communities that stand behind it.
Yeah, if you go to Andorra, for example, they have crazy shredders around there.
Yeah. I mean, sure. Jackson Goldstone. Like, is he not the first one to prove everything we're talking about? We've watched an edit of him on a Strider.
When he was
Whistler, Canada.
Yeah. And Finn.
Yeah. And Finn.
He's basically the same, just earlier.
Yeah, first, I mean, yeah. Yes, I would agree. We maybe saw less of it, but I mean, like, the whole, like, let Finn in thing when he was, who knows how young. I mean, like, Brandon, it is very similar. 14,
Brandon Turman started that.
Yeah.
What's that?
Thank you, Brandon. Brandon Turman started that.
Oh, that's sick. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, I mean, Jackson's probably, like, that first one of those riders that's done that. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's all been like broadcasted. You've just seen it from start to finish.
Well, and he's been living where he's watching other people.
Epicenter.
And yeah, I mean, he's in the epicenter for sure. But like, it's us talking about everything we've been like, the bikes, the products, the ability to watch things. Like it is, where mountain bike is just in a different state than when we all got into it.
Totally.
So
and,
like,
and
it all.
And you're close to all the racers, but like if you look back at the previous generations of really really fast guys. Like Jackson doesn't look like them on the bike, and those lines he's hitting, the way he's hitting them,
it makes no sense,
you can tell that. I don't want to throw the old guard under the bus, but like the speed isn't going to be there again for those guys. They're not going to catch that train because it's just absolutely on a different level.
Well,
he's not going to win everything.
He looks like he's playing.
But some of the lines are just, it's just absolutely different.
Yeah. Did you hear the Win TV interview after Mont Saint Anne?
No, I didn't.
It's pretty awesome. So Wynn got a lot of people on camera when they were a little buzzed. And he got...
a little? Just a little.
Yeah, totally. I don't know what state
after
it was.
After drinking responsibly?
Yeah, they definitely couldn't drive the semi out of there. But no, he got Bruni out there. And Bruni was... I'm pretty sure he was a little drunk. It was amazing. And so Bruni was going off on this and that and like hating on Brunner Kerr, which was great. And
for the record, this probably was like half a beer for Bruni. He is a lightweight.
He's probably a lightweight.
It all goes into his quads.
No, he doesn't.
Straight to my quad.
He trains for everything but drinking. But anyway, I think it was pretty telling because Bruni's on his own program. Like years and years ago, he mentioned a song he loved, which was like Underdog. And I think he trains like an underdog and voices like a champion. But he marches to his own beat. You know, he does not take cues from other people. He does his own thing. He did different testing, different setup from Loris when they were on the same team. He's by far his own person. And he said in this interview, he's like, I think it was 85 kilos. Basically the same weight as me. I think it's 187 pounds. And it was in reference to Jackson. He's like, yeah, I should get lighter. Like, that's mind blowing to me, and no one's talking about this, but yeah. You have the best in the world who's just won the World Cup. I have to change my game because I see how it's being played now and it's different.
So that brings me to, I've got a pretty cool anecdote. I went out and shot photos at a few World Cups a few years back for Vital. And I was in Lourdes, which is a super awesome track, quite difficult to ride, especially when it's wet, and it's always wet and cold. And I was sitting about, I'm going to say, two-thirds down the track, and I found this angle for a fisheye under the safety net. So it's a heinous section. It's got a very awkward rock drop. It's where the boom used to be in Lourdes. If anybody remembers where the boom camera would be, Red Bull's. Red Bull, awesome, by the way. Thanks for all the 8 years of World Cup coverage. We love you. Please come back. So in that spot, heinous spot, like a drop to flat, awful off camber. And then there's a big left turn, which is just rocks and roots. It's in a berm shape, but it's not a berm. It's rocks, roots, mayhem, big left turn, very fast. So I'm crashed down under the safety netting with my fisheye. And two riders come by. I'm not going to say the names because like it might be awkward. But let's just say between them, they have multiple world championships. They both have the rainbow stripes. They're fucking fast. And some of them have done awesome things this year also, not in racing. That's enough of the clues. First one comes by, the usual hauling ass, all that, looking pretty good on the bike. And he stops right where I am. He doesn't know I'm crouched down behind the safety net. Comes the second rider, does the line, stops in the same spot, and they're both talking about it. Da da da, this, that, the other. Wow, this is awkward, this is awkward. And then they go, oh, wait, let's move. There's a rider coming. Comes Gwyn, blasting through the section, puts the whole bike on an angle like nobody did, just through these rocks, roots, mayhem. It's awful. And he just plows through it as fast as you could imagine, and then some, goes all the way by, doesn't stop, just smokes on down the trail. Rider one turns to rider two and says, dude, we're fucked. No, they didn't know I was sitting there, and I'm looking up going, yep, pretty much. And it's like very decorated, very capable riders, just shoulders slumping down going, yeah, we can't beat that now. Point of Bruni going, I need to do something. Like that might be one of these watershed moments, because that was at the time when Gwyn was dominating, that was a pure watershed moment. Everybody had to raise their game. Like Bruni is where he is today because of Gwyn, because of how professional the training became and where you had to go look for the next level of speed.
That probably happened
just again now with the new generation.
And I think at a point, you know, Gwyn introduced a lot of training and kind of perfection in preparation. You know, Sam Hill was aggression years ago. I'm like,
line choice.
I will end up there. I will take the shortest route. I will make that work. You know, a lot of these things were kind of game changers that people had to adopt. And now I really believe it's jumping. You know, like Goldstone was jumping down the track and unweighting in certain places and pumping.
Being sprightly.
And in a very basic sense, that's jumping. And even in moto, this is happening. You know, like you see
feet up.
You see Jet Lawrence jumping over braking bumps, over rolls, like it's a jumping thing. And that is looking ahead, being centered on the bike, being in really good control and jumping. Yep. You know, like sure, anyone can get better at corners with a lot of practice, good weight, but I think the visible technique differences are you need to float, compress where you can, and jump over. And I think that's a lot easier when you're lighter.
And also backed up by pretty amazing advances in equipment and how you exploit that equipment, what you're able to measure, how you're able to set your bike up, what you can understand from what you just did, like actually setting the bike up to do that specifically, which wouldn't have been possible a few years back. Now they can dial that location in, like, oh, this happened to the suspension in this part of the track and I can fix that. I can literally do this and that, and now I can do that line or get that pump in the brake bump or whatever it is I need to do, because the precision is there and the level of performance of the stuff is there.
Yeah, and going back to like what Jason was saying, like the skate park and dirt jump background, I think a lot of those bigger bikes and even trail bikes now, you can translate, like I'm gonna ride like I'm at the skate park into one of those bikes a lot easier now than in the past, where they kind of had some shortcomings, but hardtails haven't really changed that much because their application is a little smaller scale. But on the bigger scale stuff, those bikes perform in a way where you can like, yeah, I can do this at the skate park. Watch me do it on my V10 at Val d'Isol. Yep. Like, you know,
yeah,
I think that's a lot to do with it. And then you have the setup stuff, being able to like pinpoint where it's going wrong. Like you're saying, that's super helpful.
You're bringing that back to Jason's point about Rampage. Like, actually, we don't really care who won, do we? That's a different, it's a different world. Yeah. Yeah. That's a different game.
Look at us just go off on racing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Back to racing.
Oh, yeah. Bummer. Sounds tough. Anyways.
Yeah, anyways.
I think your point about weight, though, is probably more important than people are thinking about it, because I agree. I could watch him through a straightaway, a rock garden, jumps, berms, and his ability, he has great natural ability, which is sort of a given for a lot of those dudes, but like the way he picks when to put energy into his bike in the ground, I think has to do so much with his weight. Like, we talk with Dakota all the time on B practice, and like, he's a bigger dude. I don't know what he weighs. He's probably around 180, I would guess, with gear. And he can't influence a bike into a corner the same way Jackson does, because he'll fold his bike in half. Like, he's literally too big.
And he and Bruni were talking about equipment failure at that point.
Totally.
You know, and even Menar's a very tall guy, but he's very efficient. He's
super light.
He's pretty thin.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, because I've always been of the thought, like, it's cornering is the most important, because everybody can just hold on in a straight line, and like, carrying momentum, and if you have a little more weight, especially track like MSA, momentum's going to benefit you. I mean, I remember racing Angel Fire as a junior, and Cody Warren on a fire road sitting down, passing me as I was in a tuck, and he probably had 80 pounds of me at the time. And I was like, I'm at a loss. I can't beat it. Yeah. I was like, I need the strap. I'm going to go get some ankle weights, you know? But it really is.
Taco Bell.
Oh. Took you this long to get a Taco Bell plug in. I'm impressed.
Patience is a virtue.
Yeah. But it'll be interesting to see how all that happens. And I have no idea how long we're into this. And I have no idea if people from Red Bull listen to these. They probably don't. And if they do, they're definitely not this far. But if nobody is planning a Jet Lawrence and Jackson Goldstone, some sort of Red Bull video, they're blowing it. I mean, it's perfect. Jet and Moto is doing a lot more, I think, than Jackson and Bike maybe right now. But like, they're both at the top of the sport and changing it. And the Red Bull.
I think if Jackson had had more of like a perfect year, like Jet did, like health wise and stuff, then it would have been a lot more similar.
Pretty close to perfect already. He almost won his first year elite overall title.
I don't think it's maybe like results based. I think the way Jet Lawrence rides a bike and the way that he has just come into the sport, and it's Jackson's come to the sport and done like as an elite, done like really crazy things. He's won races. Like, Jet Lawrence hasn't even tried yet, I don't think. Like, this isn't a Moto podcast, but like, if you watch Moto a lot, like, that kid is not, he is just starting. It's really crazy.
But look at their builds. They're very similar.
Totally. Yeah. And the way they, like you're talking about, like the way they float over bikes, and, you know, they're not demanding a lot from their bike, where you watch some other riders and the way they ride. I mean, Jackson reminds me a lot of Troy Brosnan a decade ago, probably. Like, the way Troy made it look more like, I weigh too little and I'm losing momentum. I need to like wring everything I can out of this track in my speed, like pump everything. Where Jackson's more like, how am I going to be as efficient as possible and get the least hung up?
Yeah.
Like, they're doing it for different reasons, but they look very similar.
And also not just break at some sections.
Yeah.
I think maybe a takeaway is go hit a lot of the jumps you can locally and help the local trail people dig and do your thing. And
if you're a kid getting into the sport, please build landings when you build trails. Those are awesome. Landings are awesome. So yes.
Nah, you don't even need the landings. Just like, you need just need to jump. Like,
no, please build landings.
Eventually.
For the old guard, build landings, please.
No way. Keep backpedaling. You'll shift your gear. You'll be good.
Last Rampage question.
Oh, no. Nice.
Who would you like to see that you haven't seen that year? Who would you like to see next year show up at Rampage or be invited?
Brage.
Yeah, for sure. Brage needs to come back and finish what he started. Yeah.
Jackson.
That's Kate interesting Edwards. One. He came from jumping.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
But all those, there's going to be a learning curve for them, though. But still, like, see him out there. Who cares, right?
Yeah. I'm curious if he's going to just show up and blow up and just be totally fine with it or...
Yeah,
G deserves it.
But we've seen G at Rampage.
We'll put a height limiter on him, like 30 feet or less, G.
Maybe the restriction.
Yeah. On the topic of Rampage, I want to publicly apologize to Cam Zink because I sent texts to many people saying, I hope he has an innocuous incident before the drop and doesn't try to flip it. And he did on his first run where he cased the jump. I'm like, yes.
You did this.
And then the wind is coming up. I'm like, yes, he's not going to flip that. I don't want to see him flip it.
He said he was going to try to originally.
Whatever he did, he got it done.
You know, that was
I'll never doubt again.
You know, that was a high pressure moment when the judges cheered like crazy when he nailed it.
They threw their pizzas.
Yeah, they did.
I don't yell at the TV savage. Ever, but I was yelling.
Like, I yelled. I actually physically yelled out. I shouted, no! When I saw him pull, I was like, no!
Yeah. You see how close? He was like, yes!
How close his tires were to the
Yo!
I mean, I feel like Red Bull and the judges and everyone who puts on that event has Cam to really thank for silencing, at least for the next 12 months, everybody bitching about it's too, like, groomed and it's all just tricks. It's becoming slope style. Cam comes in. I mean, he did tricks. It's not like, I mean, he flipped a ridiculous drop, but like he rode a technical line down the gut of that hill.
Nose barked into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So savage. People didn't really catch on to that. That was pretty fucked up. But like straight up, like nobody's really questioning if Cam should have won, right? Which in years past, that's what we're talking about. So at least we put that to bed for the next.
And era. I think like that, like during Bear Claw's video, talking about like, yeah, Bienve's flip was no doubt insane, but your line of sight into it, you can adjust your speed at any point. If you've been to Virgin, Utah and looked at any of those ridge lines, like I've ridden just the basic lunch line or whatever, and I consider myself a pretty good rider, but hiking up it, I was like, I don't know if I'm even ride down this. Mm-hmm. This is insane. Yeah. And then you see it on camera and you're like, that's like a 3 foot drop.
Yeah.
But like you can't see it until you're at it. So to go 65 feet or whatever it was at that speed and flip, it's like
off axis.
That's the like wow factor that like it does translate on the TV, but like standing there and then standing like 10 feet back from the lip is where you're just like, oh my God. Like you can't even see where you're gonna go.
Yeah, you're gonna land in Virgin.
The landing is in a different zip code.
For sure. Pretty much. You're going to lose cell service halfway through the jump.
Did you see the X Games reel of it with Zink does the flip and then Salema is just like. Dude, Zink.
What about the one wheel canyon gap?
Oh, yeah.
Dude, can we get a one wheel raw?
I'm pretty glad he failed.
No, he made it.
He made it. Third attempt. He made it.
He tried it twice more?
Yeah. For sure he did.
He landed.
He failed one more time and then landed it. Yeah.
Does that take away from Rampage?
A little bit.
Yeah. How gnarly is it?
I mean,
well, what was the other thing?
You only need one wheel, apparently.
They had the dude shoot the basketball across the Canyon Gap, and it was like, oh, world record. His basketball shot across the Canyon Gap.
Dude, perfect.
And it was like, what are you doing? Like, and I guess he's a Red Bull athlete, but like,
Red Bull's just getting.
Is this the place?
Like, maybe they're maxing it out. Why not?
Has anyone else tried? Like,
any pressing issues, any problems of the world we need to solve before we.
I have one.
Knock on.
Okay, it's the final one. We'll call it final one.
Okay.
We say that Cam and Nikolai at Rampage were pretty good commentators. I think we all enjoyed them.
Yeah.
On the trail today, we were talking about World Cup commentators today, and I said Rick is doing pretty good, and I don't really want to. I think Cedric maybe isn't quite what we need right now, and you guys have some different takes on it. I'm just curious what everybody thinks about the commentating after a year of World Cup races.
Most people don't seem to dig Rick, and I don't mind him.
I don't mind Rick either.
Cedric's giving off the Ralph Shaheen vibes.
Here's the funny story about
Ralph.
But he'd say stuff where he's like, what happened? And Ricky's like, that's what you call a rider error. That was his fault. Like, they're together, Ralph.
I think the reason Cedric is the way he is, he's always played that character.
Hold on.
You know, like, so the first time, I was super nerd. High school, college, everything. I didn't drink or anything. Mm. First time I got drunk was at the Brazil World Cup. 2005.
Yeah.
Part of
you had the borrowed bike.
He did, or
Steve P did.
I was focusing on my own stuff. I had plenty to worry about.
Enough problems.
Yeah, I had my own problems.
My own.
Body. So I was trying to go there and had a good race, but before that, we were out at a bar, and Cedric was, he was doing a really good job, like, playing Cedric. He'd get drinks, and he'd switch drinks and give them to other people, act like he was drinking, you know, but throw them out, switch. But he always had a drink in his hand. But he was never really drinking.
You just watched.
He was doing a really good job of promoting Cedric.
But you saw right through it.
For a little bit, and yeah. Then I was drunk.
Oh, God, pull the vision. No, then I was
sitting here cheering.
Yeah, then I was super drunk. But, like, so me and Matt Thompson, who, thanks to him, there's Vital. You know, like, right. We were down there, and I was, like, super, but we knew this was happening. We're like, wait a second, he's always feeding other people, and he was being a pro as far as his image. Mm. You know, he was always up in the volume, he was, you know, up in the ante as far as partying, but he wasn't actually partying.
Without actually, like, knowing how to party?
No, he was, like, he was doing a good job of, like, doing the show of Cedric, you know? And he's done that his whole career. He's made a really good career of it. Like, he's being a pro. But I still think he's doing that in commentary. He's being a little louder, you know, but it's not really anything I want to hear. Like, I want to hear something like Reese Wilson was doing with commentary, where he's like, I saw this section. This is hard for this reason. I prefer this line over this one. Gwyn and that's too. Insight. And Gwyn was really good, yeah. Too. I don't need more volume. I can adjust that on my remote.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's useless to me.
Yeah.
Watch but me. Cedric's done that his whole life.
Yeah.
Just more volume and more of a show.
Hmm. Johan, you speak French. Have you ever listened to Cedric on the French broadcast?
Not
at
much.
All?
Not much.
Is he? But is it kind of the same?
Yeah, it's amplitude? The same vibe. I mean, Cedric likes to go a bit over the top, and I don't actually mind that part. And I don't want to throw the commentators under the bus. I think the internet has done a good enough job of that. Like, if any of them,
the internet.
Yeah, if any of them read the comments, like, don't read the comments, guys. Don't read the comments. But my takeaway from a year of the new ownership and the new production behind it, as a super fan of the sport, like, not as a journalist who does this for a living, but somebody who's actually been following World Cup racing since Freecaster and, you know, that part of it. It's just been disappointing. It's been disappointing from the point of view of they came in saying, we're actually going to raise the level. Like, we know what Red Bull has been doing for 8 years. We're going to do better. In my opinion, they've done worse in all aspects of the broadcast experience. First of all, the build up to it. There's no, there used to be very nice Red Bull videos produced that would put, you know, bring you in and set the stage and get you ready for the race. That's all gone. Small little things like at the first race, we all noticed that the little timing screen is always green. So when the rider crosses the line, the time is green because that's their branded green color. But it's stupid because green is up, red is down. Like, so fix that. You had 100 comments saying it's wrong, we don't like it, fix it. And it went right through. The graphics were not on point. The filming was subpar at best. There's whole sections dedicated to close-ups. You don't get a feel for the line choice, the body language, what each rider is doing through that section. The drone was awful. The guy who flies it, like, you can pick any top 50 worldwide FPV pilots, pay the guy, get him in there. It's going to be awesome. This dude was like learning on the job, and it was awful.
A new track every week.
And a new track every week, and that's totally unfair, right?
Familiar with the
and
place.
There's all these trees, man. What are they all doing here? Why are there so many trees here? I can't fly this drone here.
I like, can't confirm this,
make it
but
really hard.
It was said that they're using a GoPro 4. On the drone,
it looks like it, or a potato. Yeah.
So like, it's actually,
sliver over the lens.
They could just throw it.
So like from
just chucking GoPros.
So from that point of view, the whole production package is lacking. Next year we get one less race, both in enduro and downhill, compared to this year. You get no race in North America. Like, this isn't growing the sport. It's blatantly obvious. You just read through the words. They're just words, and that's how they won the deal. And it's kind of unfair for the super fan who was used to a certain level and a certain vibe. We're not getting that. It's just not translating. Well, it's not coming through. Will it ever? I don't know. They can learn. Sure, they can learn a lot. But do they want to? At this point, that's what we have to question. With less races and all that, the vibe around enduro hasn't been brilliant this year. I mean, it literally went from whatever it was to almost nothing. There were weekends where we, as professional journalists, were surprised. Like, hey, wait a minute, the enduro is now? Oh, wait a minute, where are the results at? Let's make a post about it. Like, that's not how it should be.
There's like super easy things to fix. For example, just bring a film crew that is part of mountain biking and some mountain biking videographers, because you don't need to fix and teach guys that are not in this domain, this sport now. Just bring someone who already knows it. It's pretty simple.
And the small details like Rob and Elliot going through the pits and talking to people.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I spoke with him earlier this week. He was saying this was going on or this going on. Like, you don't get that anymore.
Nope. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nope.
You just get, how is he so fast? And like Jason said, like, well, the fastest rider crashed. They're like the third rider to drop. Yeah. Like, that's how they put in 8 seconds. Did you see what just happened? Like,
yeah.
Are you just lining this up in case he wins? We're like qualifier number 57. Like,
yeah. I don't know how true it is, but have heard rumblings that some of the mountain bike brands and the team managers have cited, you know, budget decreases next year. And so they might have been putting pressure on fewer rounds. I don't know if that's true, but it seems like that could be plausible.
Wouldn't that be like sorted a while ago, you would think?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, like the U.S. is such a hotbed for everything, product development, rider development, all these new hotshots coming up. So much terrain here to use to put on awesome races. And there's not one World Cup, not one. This is like the land of the brave and all that, you know, like be brave, dive in.
Went too hard in the 90s, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
No, that must have been it. The corporations that own the mountains or run them, they don't care.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, and that's, I'm afraid that the people who bought this, the media rights and this whole package, don't really care. What a bummer. That was such a down note.
Thanks, Jason.
Jason.
But so you don't, you do, or you do or don't want Cedric in the booth? What was the...
you know what?
And Rick?
You know what? If we can get better graphics and a whole better production and all that, and they could just tone it down a little, and like when Gwyn speaks, let him speak. Like, he knows what he's talking about. Yeah. Like, that would be a good starting point. They could probably learn. Like Rob and Claudio, they were rough back in the day. Yeah. So
they were
could it? Yeah, they were yeah. Could it?
Well, that was Nigel Page. And
could it improve? Yeah, it could improve. There has to be the desire to improve. And we
end this on an up note.
Cheap bikes are fun.
You got a World Cup.
Cheap bikes, anyways. We're gonna spend tomorrow riding bikes that don't cost a lot of money, and you don't need to spend a lot of money to ride bikes. You don't need to backflip.
Look, you don't need to backflip off a 60-foot drop.
The only events we complain about, all the riders are on $10,000 bikes.
No, those are only the unfortunate ones. The ones that couldn't afford the really, really good ones.
Dude, straight to Vitas was probably like $4,800 retail.
Yeah,
outdoor.
Rest in peace.
Dude, big shout out to Straight, by the way. That's a positive note to end. Because if you read the body language on run number one, he wasn't ready at the start. Like, there was a moment where he almost said, yeah, maybe not. Because as I understand, he hadn't hit the big one at that point yet. He didn't get it done that morning. So huge shout out for run number two, because that was vintage Straight all the way, like confident. The tricks were there, the huge Sui, like everything we want to see. That was super sick.
Coming from someone else who also shattered their back, I didn't come back to do anything like him, but it's pretty cool to see that stuff, because the physical stuff heals, but the mental stuff is way harder.
Yeah. That was gnarly.
Yeah,
that was pure cool. Rampage right there.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
As a fellow backbreaker, what I broke my back on, I would never want to hit again.
Yeah.
Like, I've hit bigger jumps and I'm just like, I think I can just roll that one. I don't think we need to bury that. don't need to solve that problem.
Yeah.
What do you say? The mental thing never goes away.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I feel like if when I was young, I broke my back in between World Cup races, and man, it was hard. I was so stubborn and so kind of strong in my head. I was like, no big deal. This will be fine. Don't have any concerns in the long run. It took my body so long to recover. You know, Straight and I joke about my weight or anyone else's, and he and I were pretty stout, you know? But I lost a lot of weight, and it took about a year to gain it back. And you need a lot of strength, a lot of muscular padding if you're going to, I think, do this sport at a high level. And it took me so long to get back physically that wrecked me mentally. It wasn't the first part. It wasn't the first part of, I'm injured, I have to recover.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't care. It was like the second part, the duration, and just like the day-by-day grind of, I have to eat more, I have to train, I have to eat more, I have to train. And that's super hard. separate from the skills, which are incredible on his end.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you. We're ending on Kyle Strait being a boss. Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome. Where are we? What happened? Guess the time.
It's a journey. Oh,
gosh, guess the length.
154.
Oh, wait, hold on. Oh, podcast pros in the house.
130.
137.
Yeah, I would say like 230.
Thanks. 149. So Johnny closest. Price is right. Dun, dun,
dun, dun. I'm thinking of all the trial and error to get us here.
Yeah. The last 3 hours before.
Yeah. Yep.
Don't hit delete now, Sean.
Thanks, everyone. Hopefully this sticks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.